Gamar Joba, you're tuned into the Russian Empire History Podcast. My name is Roberto, and I'm the host of the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. Our show takes place in a Caucasus region in the land of the Georgians, or the Kartveli, as they like to call themselves. Georgia comes up a lot in Russian history, and even enters the Russian Empire in the late 1790s to the early 1800s. But Georgian history is so much more than that. We start our show in the Neolithic Age and witness the rise and fall of the kings of Colchis and Iberia. We like to take a look at different myths, legends, stories, and poetry. We're also rather fond of mentioning wine, as wine was first created in Georgia. So, come get a glass of wine with us and join us in the history of Sakartvelo, Georgia. You can find us wherever you enjoy listening to podcasts, such as this one, on our website at historyofsakartvelo.com, or on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Sakartvelo is spelled Sakartvelo. Now, enjoy listening to the Russian Empire History Podcast.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast, the history of all the peoples of the Russian Empire. I'm your host, J.P. Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, The Steppe, and the Birth of the Russian Empire. Episode 8, Steppe Warriors Part 1, Horse Archers. Steppe warriors emerged among the Scythians as fearsome mounted forces, capable of defeating almost any force sedentary cultures put in their way. Their way of fighting was perfectly adapted to their lifestyle, which was perfectly adapted to their environment. And although it cannot, of course, be said that there was no change over the almost 2,000 years from the Scythians to the Mongols and the Seljuk Turks, they would all have recognized each other as peoples of the steppe. The peoples of the steppe developed a number of key innovations in weapons and equipment that were revolutionary not only for their own lives and armies, but also for the sedentary civilizations bordering the steppe. In this episode, we are going to look at those innovations and their effect on the steppe warrior. Cast your mind back a few episodes to our discussion of the Sintashta people and the origins of chariots. We looked there at why chariots provided an advantage over a mounted horseman, with one of the biggest disadvantages for horsemen being that the size of the bow meant that they were only able to shoot from one side of the horse. Despite this, the age of chariots in the steppe was far shorter than the age of the mounted archer. So what changed? To answer that question, let's start by asking, what is a bow? The bow is one of the oldest human tools and the first human invention that could store and release energy. The concept is simple. A flexible branch that is bent under tension wants to return to its normal position, and when it is released, it does so, releasing the energy stored when it was bent. The outside of the bow, if you imagine holding one in front of you, that is the side facing away from you, is stretched or placed under tensile stress. The inside of the bow is under compressive stress. The further back the bow is drawn, the greater the stress becomes, and so the greater the energy when it is released. So if you think for a minute, we can see the first requirement that ancient peoples had to consider for their bows. The wood had to combine sufficient flexibility with sufficient strength to snap back. And the material used for the string also had to be strong enough to handle the stress without snapping. They would also need to create some kind of projectile that could reliably be directed towards their target using the energy from the bow. This kind of bow, a single piece of wood that is bent and strung, is called a self-bow. The famous English longbow is perhaps the ultimate self-bow, although longbows of various kinds were in use since ancient times. Yew was the best wood for the longbow because of its particular properties. The stave was cut so that the outside third was sapwood, the less dense part of the tree, while the inside was heartwood, the densest central part of the tree. The heartwood has tremendous compressive strength, while the sapwood performs well under tensile stress. This combination made for a bow that shot with greater force than other kinds of timber. Longbows, as the name suggests, were long, usually around 180 centimeters or 6 feet, so they were not much good on horseback. Now, if you've been paying attention to the podcast so far, you might have a question right now. And that question is, if bows are made from trees, and there are no trees on the steppe, what did the Scythians and other steppe archers make their bows from? And this is what made steppe bows different. At some time, it's not clear when, the composite bow was invented. Composite, in this case, means that the bow is not made from a single piece of wood, but from several pieces combined, and not from wood alone either. The oldest remains of a bow reinforced with bone and sinew come from Siberia and date to around 2000 BCE. The earliest ones known with bone ears, that is, pieces attached to each end of the bow, come from around Lake Baikal in the 6th century BCE. Once the composite bow had been perfected, it remained essentially the same for centuries afterwards. So, we have a bow made by combining several different materials. The common ones are wood, bamboo, leather, horn, antler, and sinew. The wood or bamboo would be used for a core frame the bow was built on. This core experiences far less tension than the self-bow, so it did not need to be super strong, although care needed to be taken with selection to avoid pieces of material that would warp. This made bamboo a popular material. Unlike wood, it has no grain, so it does not warp. For timber, maple, birch, or mulberry were common. This wooden or bamboo core would be steamed into shape, and then horn would be attached to one side to form the belly of the bow. Some ancient steppe bowyer made the discovery that horn has great compressibility. It is 4 times as strong under compression as wood is, and it snaps back to shape once it is released. Buffalo and cow horns are flexible and resistant and come in long pieces. They would be shaved to size, steamed and flattened. The bowyer would then score the surfaces of the horn and the wood and glue one or more pieces of horn to the wood using fish or hide glue. Once that was done, The bow would be braced to set in a curve opposite to its completed shape. So, if you held it in front of you without a string, the tips would be bending away from you, and it would be left to dry like that for several weeks. The next step was reinforcing the other side of the bow with sinew, usually the hamstring or back tendon of a cow or deer. The tendons were dried, pounded, and glued on with glue made from fish bladders or boiling hide. Fish glue was best because of its moisture-resistant properties, and fish were abundant and easy to find in steppe rivers and lakes. The glue takes months to fully cure and could be left to dry for up to a year. Once fully dried, the glue and sinew would shrink and pre-tension the bow. This would set the curve away from the archer, which is a shape we call reflexed, solidly into a bow. Like horn under compression, sinew is around 4 times stronger than wood under tension. So what this means is that a shorter bow with a lighter draw stores the same energy as a larger self bow. Sinew's elasticity would increase this effect still further. Once the bow had achieved its final shape, it would be wrapped to protect the glue and sinew from the elements, using leather or bark, and after several months of work, the bow would be complete. The different materials bonded together made the resulting bow extremely strong and flexible. When drawing the bow, the sinew would stretch and the horn would compress, the forces combining to return the bow to its original shape, one pushing, one pulling. The composite bow could bend much further than a self bow, giving a greater draw length, how far you can pull the arrow back relative to its size. So it stored more energy and shot the arrow with greater speed and power. Compared to a self bow, a small composite bow could have the same power, was smoother in use, and could be left strung without weakening the bow. The final step in the creation of the steppe composite bow was the addition of wooden or bone ears, or siha, set at an angle to the main limbs of the bow to increase leverage and maximize the draw length. Siha were most likely first used by the Huns, and different peoples would use different materials and angles. So what's left for our bow? The bowstring. Bowstrings experience a great deal of stress, meaning the material needs to be chosen carefully. It must not stretch, and it must be a weight that fits the bow. Common materials were sinew, horsehair, vines, and later the Turks would use silk. Horsehair was the best material for the cold steppe, as it does not absorb moisture and stretch. Once the bowyer had made the bow, it would be time for the arrows. In English, we have the surnames bowyer, fletcher, stringer, and arrowsmith, derived from the corresponding professions, as making bows, arrows, strings, and arrowheads were separate specializations. But on the steppe, warriors made their own. Arrowheads were made from stone and bone, as well as metal, with quite a lot of variety depending on the task. Different arrowheads were used for birds, fish, rabbits, deer, long-range shooting, or against armored enemies. Bone remained in use for hunting arrows for centuries after metal had become standard for war. Some arrowheads were grooved to hold poison. The Scythians made a poison by mixing snake venom, rotting snake meat, blood and animal dung into a horrible sounding mixture that could make even a slight wound fatal. Different peoples had their own preferences. The most common Scythian arrow was trilobate, that is, it had three wings in a triangular arrangement, and it was quite small. Bronze ones were socketed, so the shaft of the arrow was set into the head. Turks used a leaf-shaped arrowhead, and Huns a rhomboid, which were both inset into the shaft. Cane and reed were the main materials for the arrow shafts, although wood could also be used. Reeds were easy to work with and flew well, but they are more delicate and could break on impact. Wooden arrows were more reusable. Feathers were attached in a spiral, so the arrow would spin for greater accuracy, like rifling on a gun. An archer would be able to achieve the best results if their arrows were a good weight for the bow and around the same size as each other, making the draw and flight predictable. Making their own arrows would help the steppe warriors achieve this. As you might expect, given human nature, as soon as people had bows, they began competing with each other. And we have some records of how far people could shoot with steppe bows. A stele dated to around 300 BCE, found at Olbia, records an archer achieving a shot of 521 meters. The Chinggis Khan stone, from the early 13th century, records an archer named Esuke having shot an arrow 335 ald, which is around 536 meters, or 1,750 feet. For comparison, the record for a longbow is 380 meters. The records set with steppe bows were only beaten in the modern era, when flight bows were developed for maximum distance competitions. Of course, 500-meter shots were not the norm, which is why they set up stone memorials to the people that achieved them. The effective range was more like 170 meters, a bit less than 600 feet, with the range for deadly accuracy being around 60 meters, 200 feet. For comparison, Olympic archers shoot at a target 70 meters away. It is important to note that while an archer hunting would be looking to kill, or at least bring their target down, and therefore get as close as necessary to hit the target accurately, in warfare, they were not generally shooting to kill. In warfare, the aim was to have mass flights of arrows hailing down into the ranks of the enemy, wounding soldiers, forcing them to break formation, and generally making things as unpleasant for them as possible. Debilitating injuries were as good as kills, maybe even better sometimes, as then the wounded would need to be helped, slowing down and burdening their comrades as well, and maybe dying a horrible death days later, with that Scythian rotten snake and cow dung poison in their veins. Steppe archers would shoot upward. Images show angles around 45 degrees, so that massed arrows would fall from above. In the Historia Tatarorum, written by C. de Bridia, a member of the Franciscan mission to Batu Khan and Guyak Khan, the attacks are described as follows, quote, "As soon as their arrows can reach the mark unhindered, they are said, owing to the density of their fire, to rain arrows rather than shoot them." Scythian, Avar, and Turk cavalry archers carried 150 or more arrows each, and could fire 12 arrows a minute consistently. English longbowmen aimed for a rate of 6 shots per minute, while heavy crossbows could only manage 1. The Parthians, who rode out of the steppe into Iran, where they ruled for around 500 years, knew how valuable this rate of fire was. The Parthian general Surena destroyed a Roman army led by Crassus at Carrhae in 53 BCE, using a centralized logistical system to continually resupply his mounted archers. The motion of fitting the arrow to the string, or knocking it, and pulling it back for release is called the draw, and there were different styles of doing it. The Scythians, and all the steppe people after them, used a thumb draw, also known as a Mongolian draw. In the thumb draw, the thumb draws the string, while the forefinger keeps the arrow in contact until release. It is more difficult to master than the so-called Mediterranean draw, which was used further west. In the Mediterranean draw, the arrow is gripped between thumb and three fingers. Steppe children would be shooting almost as soon as they could walk, and would be masters of the thumb draw by their teens. The thumb draw has the arrow to the right side of the bow, while in the Mediterranean draw, the arrow is on the left. This helps the thumb draw avoid bruising the left forearm as the string snaps forward, and the thumb draw is also faster. The most important factor in the development of the thumb draw was the use of the short bow on horseback. If you hold your arms up and try to mimic these draws, you will find that your hand twists as you draw back. The thumb draw is more comfortable with that twist, but more crucially, the draw and twist movement secures the arrow against the string, while the Mediterranean style draw does not. The fingers pinch and it is uncomfortable to fully draw to the maximum extent. If you think about keeping a loose arrow on the string while riding at speed, you can instantly see how important this was. Persians later developed their own variation, with the forefinger lying along the arrow rather than pressing to the thumb. But this still achieved the key requirement of fixing the arrow to the string. The Mediterranean draw was limited to use by foot archers. Thumb rings made of metal, horn, bone, or leather were worn for a better and more comfortable draw and quicker release. One more interesting thing about draws. The Roman historian Ammianus, who was born in 330 and died around the end of the 4th century, saw steppe archers while fighting the Persians and was surprised by the length of their draw. If you mimicked a draw when I asked you to a few minutes ago, you probably drew your hand back towards your face, didn't you? It seems as if it would be natural to raise the bow and sight along the arrow. Steppe archers drew towards their face, and later Mongolian archers drew past their ear for even greater power. Romans, however, drew to the center of their chest, and so they were rubbish archers. Sometimes you come across something in history and wonder how people could ever have done that, instead of what people did later, which seems completely obvious. Having done some archery, this is one of those cases for me. Drawing to the chest only gives you about half the draw distance, and makes it impossible to sight along the arrow. Just seems completely counterintuitive. One unique thing the Scythians used was the garitos. That's the Greek name. We don't know what the Scythians called it. The garitos was a combined quiver and bow holder worn from a hook on the belt. It's a good illustration of how much time Scythians spent in the saddle, as it can't have been comfortable or convenient to walk around with one, but it kept everything at hand on horseback. Besides the Scythians and their related peoples, like the early Parthians, No one else used the Garitos. Other steppe peoples had a plain quiver slung over a shoulder or at the belt. Two main shapes were used. First, there was a simple tube-shaped container. But Huns, Avars, and Mongols also used a wide quiver with a narrow waist, sort of an hourglass shape. The arrows were carried in this point up to make it easy to see the different arrowheads and choose the right kind of arrow for whatever they were shooting. The wide base stopped the fletching getting crushed, while the narrow waist would hold the arrows so they didn't shake around. The other steppe peoples kept their bows strung in a separate case, usually carried on the opposite side to the quiver, while unstrung bows could be stored in a leather cover to protect them from the elements. So if we think back again to where we were at the beginning of this episode and our comparison of chariots and horses, it should be quite easy to see that the Scythian's short, powerful, composite bow not only eliminates the main factors counting against mounted archers, it gives them the advantage. Now, an archer on horseback could fire rapidly in any direction, including behind themselves, as in the famous Parthian shot. The horse warrior had greater mobility, could get by with one horse if necessary, while a chariot could not, and could keep replacement horses more easily, as they would need less training than a chariot team. Cavalry armies could maneuver in larger numbers, faster, and with greater precision than chariots. With the appearance of the Scythian mounted archers, the age of the chariot was over in the steppe, and it would gradually give way to the age of cavalry everywhere else. The composite bow changed little conceptually over subsequent centuries, although refinements continued to be made. The Huns added the siha, or ears, end pieces set at an extreme angle to the center of the bow, to increase the leverage and shooting power. Huns also used an asymmetrical bow, with the upper bend longer than the lower, again increasing the power, while still being suitable for use on horseback. The Avar made some adjustments to the shape and angle of the bow and siha, and their bows were adopted by Byzantine armies in the 5th century. The final refinements were made by the Seljuk Turks after they emerged from the steppe into Anatolia. Flight archery, that is, shooting for distance rather than at a target, became a popular competitive endeavor in the Ottoman Empire, even after firearms reduced the importance of archery in war. Special fields, called okmedani, were laid out for competitions, and columns commemorating especially impressive shots were erected, with several still existing today. In 1798, Sultan Selim III managed to shoot an impressive 889 meters, or just under 3,000 feet. A good bow became a symbol of high status in the steppe. Although horses, swords, spears, and all kinds of treasure have been found in the Khorgans, very few bows have been found. They may just have been too valuable to bury. So, besides the bow, what else did steppe archers carry? Scythians and Sakas carried a short sword, later adopted by the Persians and called the Akinakes. These had a blade 35 to 70 centimeters in length and can be seen in the images of Scythian warriors found in the Khorgans. The length made it unlikely that these swords were used much on horseback. They were most likely intended for close personal defense or finishing off the wounded on the battlefield. Longer swords of around 1 meter, with a heart-shaped guard and knob pommel, became more common in the 2nd century BCE. Sarmatians also used the short sword, even a bit shorter than the Scythians, with a ring-shaped pommel, and likewise straight and two-edged like the Akinakis. The Huns preferred a long, straight, two-edged sword, sometimes even two-handed. The Avars moved to a single-edged sword, and then gradually evolved the curved sword by around the 7th century. These sabers were effective, particularly when cutting down from horseback into foot soldiers, but took some time to become widespread due to the difficulty of manufacturing. The Scythians only carried the Akinakis, but as longer swords became the norm, daggers were also adopted, and it became standard for warriors to carry a sword and a dagger. Javelins and lances were also used on the steppe. The difference here is in weight and use. A javelin is lighter and is intended to be thrown as well as used in the hand. Lances are heavier, often longer, and used in hand. As we heard in episode 4, the javelin may have been a steppe innovation alongside the chariot. Scythians used javelins, 2 to 3 meters in length, for throwing and thrusting. Contemporary reports describe them as being highly accurate, both in war and in hunting, where riders would compete to spear rabbits to demonstrate their precision. The Sarmatians adopted lances for their heavy cavalry, and so did the Huns. Mongol lancers also attached a hook to their lances for pulling the enemy from the saddle. Small battle axes, maces, and lassos were also common. Shields appear only rarely in the images of steppe warriors, and were made of leather on a reed frame. So what about armor? Typically, steppe warriors were only lightly armored. In the early days, often with no armor whatsoever. They relied on speed and long-range attacks to protect them. Another Roman historian, Cassius Dio, wrote that Sarmatians thrown from their horses were easy prey. But that is not to say that armor was unknown. A number of the depictions of Scythians found in the Korgans show them wearing Greek-style breastplates, for instance. As the rest of the style and detail of the work is not Greek, we must assume that this accurately depicts Scythians adopting Greek armor, rather than the artist just following their usual models. Sarmatian archers, their light cavalry, wore leather cuirasses over padded jackets, while their heavy lancers gradually moved to wearing quite heavy armor. According to Ammianus, the Alans wore scale armor made of horn. By the time of the Mongols, sophisticatedly crafted leather and metal lamellar armor was in use. From the Huns onwards, chainmail was also worn. Hats seem to have been worn basically all the time by steppe nomads, typically conical with ear flaps, and many wore helmets of a similar design. Particularly impressive were the Cuman helmets, with a full face guard worked to depict features and facial hair. Another distinguishing feature of steppe riders was their boots. Many contemporary writers through the centuries noted that, unlike most people at the time, all the steppe people wore boots all the time. The Scythians wore flat-soled ankle boots. The Mongols wore massive knee-high boots that were allegedly difficult to walk in, probably to allow insulation against the cold eastern steppe winters. Even today, the ichigi, soft leather boots with a low heel, are considered an essential part of the Tatar national costume. Under everything else, they wore loose trousers and a long coat, buttoned or tied into place. We can probably thank the earliest riders of the steppe for inventing trousers, and this basic costume, though varied by materials, colours, and decorations, remained almost unchanged for millennia. Now let's take a look at their horses. If you recall episodes 2 and 3, we talked a bit about the origins of the horse and the last surviving wild horses, Przewalski's horse. Although tough and strong, these are quite small, only around 12 to 14 hands, and it is unlikely that any horses were much bigger than that in the early days of domestication. Naturally, people began breeding horses to be bigger, stronger, and faster almost straight away. A few of the breeds developed have survived down to modern times, such as the Akhal Teki in Turkmenistan, a tall and light horse used by cavalry for 3,000 years, Buryats, Altai, and Mongolian ponies. The Pazaric Kurgans contain Turkmen horses, an ancient breed still found in Central Asia. Domesticated horses were bred back with Przewalskis for their hardiness. The Przewalski is well adapted to the steppe environment, capable of digging through half a meter of snow to find food and coping with temperatures as low as minus 50 Celsius. They would be the lowest maintenance horses available to wandering steppe warriors. Another advantage of the Przewalski that was crucial to the horseshoeless steppe was their strong hooves. The Greek historian and military leader Xenophon gave considerable thought to preparing horses for expeditions and how their feet should be conditioned, saying that a warhorse was worthless if lame. Przewalskis and the steppe horses bred with them had hooves as thick and resistant to injury as their shaggy winter coats were thick and resistant to cold. Breeding the taller, faster horses developed at the periphery of the steppe, with hardy wild stock, gave the Scythians and later nomads horses that combined speed with toughness, hardiness, and low care maintenance. The people they interacted with recognized the superiority of their horses. Ammianus called them ugly but hardy, and tried to trade for them. Philip brought them to Macedon to improve his army, while the Chinese were ready to pay enormous sums for horses from the northern barbarians. It does seem, though, that the best horses were held back, and sometimes unwanted horses were exported. Steppe warriors kept several remounts per man to allow them to travel further without overtiring their horses. European visitors to the Mongols reported them changing horses 3 times a day. On their campaigns in the Middle East, warriors were required to have 8 remounts. Records of other campaigns say up to 20 remounts per warrior. I mentioned bits when discussing the early Indo-Europeans, and as horse riding evolved on the steppe, it is quite natural that this is where the equipment also evolved. The Scythians invented the metal snaffle bit, which is largely the same as those used today, an improvement on the bone or leather bits previously used. And they also seem to have started development of the saddle. The Scythian saddle was an arrangement of cushions, with a frame being added by the Sarmatians. By the time the Hun invaded Europe, they had wooden frame saddles. Once the frame saddle had been invented, stirrups could be added. No one knows when this happened. The Avars were the first to bring them to the West, but it seems that Turkic tribes were using them well before that. There is a gold torque found in a Kurgan and dated to 300 BCE that shows a rider with feet positioned forwards as if in stirrups, and with what appears to be straps around the feet. If stirrups were really available that early, it took a long time for their use to spread. Saddles and stirrups gave horse warriors a more stable platform to fight from, but they did not become widespread until the 6th century. And as steppe warriors had been successfully fighting for 1,000 years by that point, they cannot be regarded as critical. Steppe archers did take advantage of being able to stand in the stirrups to loosen arrow, but stirrups were perhaps not that much benefit as far as controlling the horse goes for people who had lived in the saddle from early childhood. You should now have a fair image of the steppe warrior in your imagination. A rider in trousers, coat and boots, wearing a pointy hat, sitting on a shaggy horse with a short curved bow and a quiver full of arrows. In the next episode, we will look at the culture and beliefs of the steppe, and how these innovations in weapons and equipment combined with their lifestyle to make the fearsome nomad warriors. Check out the socials for maps and pictures to go with the episodes of the Russian Empire History Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Please follow or subscribe on the podcatcher of your choice and share with your friends. If you would like to help support this podcast, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or Good Pods. And thank you very much to those of you who already have. You can reach me through Facebook or at hello@therussianempirehistorypodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will join me next time.